Shall we go? Oh. So for the last 5-10 minutes, I've been wandering here and tormenting over whether I should go to the men's room or not. And I think I'm going to regret my decision in about 30 minutes. You're here for square one, and it's just going to go downhill from here. Quick piece of housekeeping. We tweet. It's inevitable. I'm Rainy Pixels. Lowercase. Don't do camel notation. That's creepy because I read it as Rainy Pixels. And so at Rainy Pixels, if you want me to see it. If we can standardize on SQR1 as the hashtag for this session, if you tweet something that you like, you don't like, and the hashtag for Mixless Mix 11. If you've been here in the past 2 years to my sessions, how many repeat customers are there? Wow. I sucked that bad last year. So everyone's new, so this will be useful. My talk is based on a lot of reading and a lot of research, and I make a lot of references. Be lazy. I have handouts that are probably going to be adequate for everyone, so you can just pay attention, and you can come and get a handout later. Last year, I had 50 handouts, and I got 100 people really pissed off at me. So this year, I have 200 handouts. I'm sure only 5 of you will come up later. Murphy's Law. So welcome to Back to Square One. Thanks for coming to the last session on Wednesday, on Hump Day. The good news is happy hours right after this, and I guess Uber happy hour, the mixed party, is right after that. So we'll all go straight to that. My name is Nishant Kothari. For most of you, it seems like you don't know me. I go by Rainy Pixels, as I said. Very quick introduction. By day, I help run the Mix Online community. Visit Mix.com. You guys have probably been to the site. We're the sister community to the conference, but we've grown to be a lot more. For the past few years, I've been fairly involved with Mix. I started the UX track at Mix 3 years ago, and I've owned the UX content for the last 2 years. Unofficially, I'm the design advocate. That's what they call me. This year, though, I haven't done any of that. I'm just speaking, which is really refreshing. Last couple of years, if you saw Bill Buxton's keynote, I managed Bill Buxton's keynote. I brought Deborah Adler a few years ago to the conference, and I managed her keynote, too. When I'm not doing that stuff, I write on rainypixels.com, which is my personal site. And my wife and I actually started a little company by the name of Minky, which sounds like moonlighting, but it's just a side project. But we're not here to talk about me. Is this really loud? Because I'm whispering. No? Because I'm going to start yelling pretty soon once I get warmed up. Brace yourselves. We're here to answer a $64,000 question that we've all had at some point in our lives. Why do we suck at predictably building great software? We've all had this at some point, right? If you haven't, come talk to me later. I'd love to work at your company. That's what we're going to be talking about. And so this is an excerpt from an IEEE article about that exact topic. And they stack ranked all these reasons for why software projects fail. And these are the top reasons. And I went ahead and bucketed them. And if you see, most of what we blame is process. Process killed the project. Every once in a while, we blame product itself, right? Maybe the subparts of the product weren't really that good. Every now and then, we blame the people. It was the politics. And that's not when we run out of reasons. We have a lot more reasons. And my experience has been pretty much all of them fall under the WTF bucket. So for the purpose of this presentation, most software projects fail because of one of three reasons: process, product, or people. And I feel like we spend an inordinate amount of time discussing process and product, how they cause software product failures. We don't spend any time talking about people, which is ironic because people are what bring processes and products to the world, right? And I think we don't talk about people because it's nerve-wracking. It's nerve-wracking to be self-deprecating, to be self-critical. And after all, we're like the most evolved species, right? We can do whatever we want. We can kill anything that moves and eat it. And we can, you know, write books, and we can create big companies, or we can endorse Celine Dion with $120 million contract to play 200 shows in Vegas, right? We do crazy things because we're people. By the way, if you didn't catch that reference, you guys weren't here last year. I had this I had this spiel about, well, it was more of a rant. I just totally went on a rant about subjectivity in design. I had this whole section in my talk. And I kind of made a dig at Celine Dion, and I said, I draw the line at Celine Dion when it comes to musical taste. Karma is B star asterisk. Because this year, my wife is actually flying in on Thursday, and on Friday, so I'm a little bitter. In her defense, I did lose my wedding band in Vegas last year. Yeah. So, yeah. I'm going to be talking about people because my experiences over the past decade and every project that I've been on that's failed, without any exception, the process was never the problem. The product was never the problem. The people is where everything blew up. Everyone, including me. So we're going to try to cover people in a very brief amount of time because this is a very complicated topic. So bear with me. Specifically, I'm going to talk about how we're flawed in three fundamental ways and how we perceive the world, how we're built, and how we solve problems. So most of the talk is going to be about that. And it's going to lead to something, I hope. But before we begin, it's so awesome that you guys weren't here last year because this is all new. This is like a trick I used last year. I was telling my counterpart, Joshua Allen, on the team that I was going to do this presentation last year, and it was called The Elephant in the Room. And it was a different presentation, but it was kind of the same thing. It was a stressful topic to talk about, right? Talk about ourselves. And he was like, man, that seems like a damper. And I think it was good feedback because I was like, well, maybe I'll do something in the presentation that'll keep your spirits elevated. So I thought about what I do every time I'm stressed at work. And the first thing I do is I go look for pictures of cute puppies. So I did this last year. Every few slides, we're going to look at pictures of cute animals. We're going to relax. This is a really shabby excuse for the fact that I'm very obsessed with my dog. In fact, he's the mascot of my website. That's actually Yoshi. And that is my cat. That picture hasn't been doctored. I don't know what's going on there. Anyway, this year there's a bit of a twist. And the twist is I'm going to superimpose a celebrity caption on this picture, which I thought paired pretty well. And the first person to guess out the celebrity name is going to get a secret prize at the end of the presentation. All right, so are we ready to do this? You guys got to be a little more rowdy. This is Vegas. I know it's 5 p.m. But the wow. I didn't even have a try on that one. All right, so here comes the tagline. The first person to guess the answer is going to get a prize at the end of the presentation. And there are going to be more. All right, we ready? No. Yes, who was that? Frank Sinatra. So how do we do this? I would jump off, but I feel like it would just cause chaos. Could we just hand this to the gentleman back there? I don't even going to come close to that because feedback and all that stuff. Good guess. That is actually Frank Sinatra, and I thought that was a very fitting caption. I was happy when I found it. All right, so a good place to start the discussion about how we're all pretty messed up is to start at the beginning, when we were born, right? And a good way to put a lens on this topic is to think about an activity that we all share in common. And the activity we share in common is we all draw. We all drew at some point. In fact, most of us drew before we talked, right? We picked up a crayon when we were really young, and we scribbled it across a piece of paper, and we were in amazement of what that did. And we couldn't stop doing that. We scribble all the time. And then as we got a little older, we realized the definition of art, right? We made this uniquely human jump to what art means. And art means you can use a symbol on a piece of paper that represents something in the real world. So for instance, Emma here, I think this one is titled A Day with the Squirrel. That red thing is the squirrel. So we sucked. But it's pretty amazing that we took something in our minds, right? We had these icons of objects. We have this verbal system, these symbols that we are able to represent using very primitive shapes. You fast forward a little bit to maybe the age of 6. And our perspective has broadened. We're looking beyond our local space. And we also learn, we make another unique human jump. we start telling stories using pictures. Shapes are still pretty primitive, and if you see now, take a look at the cloud, for instance, that's not what clouds look like. So we have the symbol that we have in our mind for a cloud, and we refine it over time, and we keep reproducing it, because that's what we think a cloud looks like, or that's our best guess of it. So kind of fast forward to the age of 12 or so. This is a very interesting age for most kids. This is when realism becomes a very prized goal. We want to very realistically depict everything that we can see. We don't really care about context. We don't care about the story as much anymore, but we really want to show that we can see the world. And Sarah could do it pretty well, right? Most of us can't do this at this age. But the thing about realism is we have to accept a really vexing paradox about drawing realistically. And the paradox is, by the age of 10 or 12, we're thinking in words. We have a lot of words stored in our mind, just a big hash table of words, and we have symbols associated with them. So take this instance for if you had to draw a cube, for instance, and you place it on a desk, and you told a child to draw a cube. Most children will know that a cube is six squares all adjacent to each other. They're all equal size squares. But to draw it in true perspective from a certain angle, the child has to accept the paradox that to draw a square cube, they're going to have to draw unsquare squares. It's really tough. Most of us don't make that jump, much like the examples at the bottom. That's just a child trying to reproduce that. And then if you take the topic of like maybe doing a self-portrait, which is one of the most daunting things for most people, is to sit in front of a mirror and then recreate yourself. I mean, we're really bad. So PETA is actually my wife. She's 31, which now I regret saying. And she did this. Yeah, this is recorded. This is what I hate about recording. I have no filter. And it's there forever now. This is why I wish for Armageddon. I don't really. It's a joke. He said he wishes for Armageddon. Never again. She drew this 2 weeks ago. Clearly, she placed herself in a bucket that most of us place ourselves in, which is, I can't draw. Very few of us are able to place ourselves in the bucket that I can't draw. Probably a good place to de-stress a little bit. He loves to be on his back. We don't know why, but he loves looking at the world upside down. Are we ready for the tagline? Okay. Hey, are we doing politics already? And applause. I'll give you a clue. Her dad owns a lot of hotels. I don't know who said that. I think I heard you first. I heard Pac come from right there. So, sorry. Can I just give this to you?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, so let's jump back. So why is it that we can't draw? Is it because most of us aren't gifted? Because we come up with all sorts of WTF reasons for why we can't draw. I'm mathematically inclined. I'm not artistically inclined. Hand-eye coordination isn't there. There are hundreds of reasons that we come up with. All of them fall under the WTF bucket, for the most part. So to understand why we can't draw, we need to go a little deeper into our brain. And you guys have seen this chart, right? The brain is split into two hemispheres, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. They're sort of identical, but each one does performs different functions. If you don't know this, your left hemisphere actually controls the right side of your body. Your right hemisphere controls the left side of your body. So if you get injured in your left hemisphere and you're going to develop any sort of paralysis, most likely it'll happen on the right hemisphere. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is this bias. We live in a generation where we're biased against right hemisphere. In fact, medically, for the last 300 years, on medical charts, the left hemisphere has been called the dominant hemisphere, while the right one's been called the subordinate one. We see it in language, too, that bias. So take, for instance, in Latin, left hand. Remember, left hand is controlled by the right brain, which is inferior, which is subordinate, according to what we've believed for a long time. But left hand, the word is sinister, right? For right hand, the word is dexter, which means skillful or adroit. French, left hand means gauche, which is, I think, awkward. Right hand, I'd pronounce it, but I won't. It's spelled droit, D-R-O-I-T, meaning good or just or proper. Even English, left comes from Anglo-Saxon, which is luft, and that means weak or worthless. Right hand comes from right, R-I-H-T, which means straight or just. I mean, we truly believe that left brain thinking is the right way to go. Zing. So turns out that was all BS. A guy by the name of Roger Sperry in the 60s or 70s did these experiments on split-brain patients. So split-brain patients are people who have the corpus callosum, which is this thick nerve fiber between the two hemispheres, they have that severed. And it turns out that and the function that the corpus callosum serves is to transmit information between the two hemispheres. And then we form our perceptions, and then we send signals to different parts of our body. For split-brain patients, they didn't have a corpus callosum. Turns out you can function pretty well without a corpus callosum. Nobody could tell you're missing a big part of your brain. But what's interesting about these people is they have fully functioning left and right hemispheres that don't know about each other. It's like two people in one. So Sperry had a really ingenious experiment. Actually, he had a lot of ingenious experiments, but this is the one that I think will help me make my point. He took a split-brain patient and placed him in front of a screen and had him focus on the midpoint of that screen. And then very quickly, he flashed two images, a spoon on the left and a knife on the right. And the way he flashed it, each hemisphere only received one of the images. So just so you can keep track of it, the right brain saw the spoon. The left brain saw the knife. Then Sperry came out and asked the split-brain patients, and he did this repeatedly, and he won a Nobel Prize for this research. He'd come out and ask the patient, so what did you see? Without fail, the patient would always immediately say, knife, I saw a knife. So Sperry would be like, okay, can you reach in the drawer right below the screen, feel around with your left hand? Remember, now he's asking a question to the right brain. So reach around with your left hand and find the object that you saw. So the guy would inevitably reach around, and because the right brain saw the spoon, he would pull out a spoon and hold it up. And then Sperry would ask the guy, what's the object you're holding? And the guy would say, a knife. And then he'd start shaking his head. And then he'd catch himself shaking his head and go say, why am I shaking my head? Fascinating stuff, right? Come back to drawing for an instant. You've seen this optical illusion. You see a vase, you see two profiles. So Betty Edwards, who's, I'm using all her research to sound smart, all this stuff is from her book, and it's in the reading list that I have at the end. She devised this very ingenious little study that we all can do. And you basically start with a half complete, so one of the profiles is complete, and you take someone who's right-handed and make them do the left profile. So you, if you can't understand what I'm saying, I'm going to show you a video of this, so don't worry about it. So you trace over the left profile, which is already complete, and while you're tracing over it, you say the part of the body that, or part of the head that you're on. So you say forehead, nose, upper lip, lower lip, chin, and so on. And then you shift over and complete the mirror image. So I made my wife do this. See, my wife's a great sport. She's been a whole part of this presentation. So I made her do this exercise, and let's just watch what happens.
Forehead, nose, upper lip, lower lip, chin, neck. Okay,
now she flips over and she's got to complete the image.
Are you sensing confusion? What is that?
Why this seems weird.
I'm not very polite, clearly.
So try to stop thinking about the words and just copy the image now. Just do the mirror image.
So now she's actively blocking out any sort of labeling to what she's seeing. She's pushing back on her left brain. And you can see her struggling at this point. This has nothing to do with the fact that she can't draw. Nothing. And I'll prove it later.
How'd you?
By looking at that side and thinking of it as a vase, then I could draw the rest.
And why did you get messed up?
Because I was thinking of it as another face, looking at that face. That's when it was hard. But it was, so I could feel like I could fix the...
So Sperry actually found two things that are really relevant to us. One is that the left brain is really loud, and that's by design. The left brain is the one that's actually helped us survive over years. One of the main functions it serves is to quickly analyze the situation, parse the information, and help us do something. But it's the first one to always answer, and it's the one that yells the answer. And every time the right brain comes in, it yells at the right brain. The second thing that Sperry found was that the left brain confabulates. When it doesn't have enough information, it fills in the gaps. It doesn't matter what those gaps are. It doesn't matter how it fills it in, so long as it can fill in the gaps. What we know of the left and the right brain now is very interesting, because if you look at the list of what we associate with the left hemisphere and what we associate with the right hemisphere, I'd hazard a guess that most of you would rather be on the right-hand side for how you are in your lives. For instance, holistic thinking occurs in the right brain. The left brain is very linear, and this might align with some of the stereotypes that you have about designers or developers or business people. The right brain is non-temporal. Again, aligns with the stereotype. Artsy people don't care about schedules, right? But the one thing that strikes me is that the left brain is very inadequate without the right brain. The right brain is involved in very high cognitive thinking, which is what we never knew. So PETA first did that sketch, then she did that exercise, and we kind of talked about right and left brain, and then I forced her to sit down and do another portrait. The portrait on the right was done 15 minutes after the one on the left, right? Look at the difference. Look at the detail. She was kind of, you remember Bob Ross? He'd just be like, happy trees, relax, right? That's one of the things that you have to do to get your left brain to leave. Drawing is a right brain exercise, and it's very tough to draw because our left brain is actually so loud and dominant and confabulates. Probably a good time for another one of Yoshi's. See, I told you he likes sleeping on his back. We actually came upstairs and we saw him just laying there, so we turned on the lights and he just kept looking at us. So we were like, hey, let's do stuff. So we put a tulip on him. We turned the lights off and left and he was still sleeping. No, good, guys, you're warm. What'd you say? Yes, our favorite Scientologist. It was Tom Cruise who actually said that. Oh, thank you for coming up. Oh, see, I told you. It's going to cause chaos if I stand next to that thing. So we have these weird perceptions about how the world is. We store the world in a very weird way in our minds, and each one of us has a different reality. At the same time, we're pretty impaired in how we're able to use our own physiology. But to top it off, we're under the spell of many of these, I call them distortions of reality. There are these things that parade around as fact in our industry. And the one I talked about last year is that design is subjective, which is not true. Design is not subjective. You guys have saw the oatmeal cartoon about how like a guy brings his mother in and he's like, oh, look, my mother didn't like that color, hence design is subjective. But another distortion of reality that tracks pretty close to this topic is that we have this propensity to favor data, right? And now that you know a little bit about the left brain, you can understand why we have this propensity to favor data. In fact, we have such a propensity to favor data, even if that data is inadequate. And most times, data about any situation is inadequate, because the data that you know at any given moment about a situation is most likely very small as compared to the data that exists in that situation, right? But this propensity is so prevalent that we have a term for it. It's called the McNamara fallacy. And it's named after Robert McNamara, who was kind of the architect of the Vietnam War. So McNamara basically was adamant that we we did well in the Vietnam War, that we won. And his justification was based on a spreadsheet. And that spreadsheet had one key element in it, and that was enemy body count, right? The problem is the moment we have these spreadsheets, we start gaming these spreadsheets, right? So there were a lot of things going on in the field, like inflating the body counts and so on. So I pulled this from the Wikipedia page, which I usually don't do, but I thought the McNamara fallacy had a great Wikipedia page. And this is a layman's way to explain it. The first step is to measure whatever can be easily measured. This is okay as far as it goes. The second step is to disregard that which can't easily be measured or to give it an arbitrary quantitative value. This is artificial and misleading. The third step is to presume that what can't be measured easily really isn't important. This is blindness. The fourth step is to say that what can't be easily measured really doesn't exist. This is suicide. Now, I'm pretty sure when I read this out to you, most of you had some situation that came up in your mind from work or just from life where you've seen this and you kind of chuckled to yourself, right? But the reality is this, we do this on a daily basis. And how this transpires in real life, and again, this is from that page too. Ted has a lot of money. Lots of money makes a person happy. Ted says that he is depressed. What Ted says doesn't necessarily indicate how he feels. Hence, depression can't be proven, and therefore Ted is happy. We laugh, but how often do we do this in software, in the industry, right? We do this all the time. We measure something that we can measure, and we get attached to it. I mean, even when you put up a conference, you get attached to this notion that you want 20% designers, you want 20% developers, you want 20% business decision makers. We categorize things, and we simplify them, and we have this naive empiricism. And the reason we have that is because the alternative to data is really scary for most of us. The alternative is intuition. And we've proven to ourselves that intuition is just voodoo. It's black magic. And the way we've proven this is by using these kind of things, like the Linda problem, which Daniel Kahneman actually won a Nobel Prize for proving to the world that our intuition can never be trusted. I was actually exposed to this as when I took my first logic class as a computer science student years ago. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And then for a while, I believed that computers were smarter than us. So let's actually do this quiz together. Linda is 31, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. All right, so you have some context. There are no trick questions here. We're going to have two options, and I'm going to ask you to place yourselves in one of the two buckets. So which of the following two alternatives is more probable based on what you know about Linda? A, Linda is a bank teller, or B, Linda is a bank teller and active in the feminist movement. Everyone in favor of A? So all of you, I'm going to assume, are in favor of B. Everyone in favor of B, raise your hand. Okay, so it was a trick question. The answer is A. And when this is actually done as a real study, 85 out of 100 people actually say that B is the answer. Now, the reason A is the answer, I find, is a little ridiculous. It's a simple axiom of logic that the probability of two independent events occurring together can never be larger than the probability of one of those events occurring independently. Now, the problem with the Linda problem is that we've taken the word probable and we've diluted it down from natural language, which is very complex and very rich, to math, which is very, I hate to say it, primitive, right? And I'll prove my point to you. So there's this other rule around communicativity, around things being communicative. See, that's going to be on video. It's like, dude, he couldn't say that word. I can't. So we know that the word and, for instance, is communicative, right? A and B is equal to B and A in math. In math, though. Take these two statements. Celine and Renee married, and Celine became pregnant. Or Celine became pregnant, and Celine and Renee married. Instantly, you know that those two sentences mean completely different things, right? Right? And there's a high likelihood that Celine and Renee were in Vegas, too. The first one means Celine and Renee married. They were a happy couple, and they got married, and they moved into a house, and then, you know, they had a baby. The second one means something bad happened in Vegas, and Renee was like, oh, crap. How do we know this? This example shares three things about intuition that are three characteristics of intuition. I know the meaning, I act on it, but I do not know how I know it, which is what frightens us. But the fact is that there's no other context around this, but we are right. Most likely we are right about the assessment we made. Intuition is extremely intelligent. We can't articulate it because parts of our brain aren't verbal, like the right brain. Intuition is extremely important to making decisions in software. What's interesting, though, is we've been trying to crack this AI bug, right? Like, we want to emulate intelligence. We've been trying to do it for so long. And I don't know if you guys recently saw this, but IBM created this computer, Watson. Now, the debates are raging about whether that's intelligence or not. I'm in favor of, yes, that is. But Watson beat the two reigning champions at Jeopardy, right? That's crazy. Chess, seems easy. You could do it as a senior project in computer science. You probably can't, but it's feasible. This is weird. It's a computer that understands English. So I want to play you a clip, and while I play you the clip for the people who haven't seen this, focus on the little visualization that comes up every time Watson answers a question.
Toronto is now a U.S. city. What you're looking at, folks, are yesterday's scores. All right, let's get rid of those scores. The luck of the draw has given Watson the first selection today, so let's play the Jeopardy round. And here are the categories. We start off with EU, the European Union. Next, actors who direct. Dialing for dialects. Breaking news. $1 or less. And also on your computer keys. Watson, start us, please.
The European Union for 200.
Each year, the EU selects capitals of culture. One of the 2010 cities was this Turkish meeting place of cultures. Watson.
What is Istanbul?
You're right.
800, same category.
Elected every 5 years, it has 736 members from seven parties. Watson.
What is Parliament?
Right.
1,000, same category.
As of 2010, Croatia and Macedonia are candidates, but this is the only former Yugoslav republic in the EU. Brad.
What is Bosnia?
No.
Oh, poor Brad. Watson won against Ken Jennings, who was undefeated, and Brad Rutter, who I think had the highest winnings on Jeopardy. And that visualization that you were seeing was Watson displaying what it thought the top three answers were with the probability of what those how those answers could be right. What was interesting is Watson isn't connected to the internet. This is not brute force. Watson has learned over 5 years. And I don't do it justice, but Ken Jennings actually wrote a fantastic article called My Puny Little Brain, and I want to read you an excerpt about what he said about Watson. Watson seems to represent a giant leap forward in the field of natural language processing, the ability to understand and respond to everyday English the way Ask Jeeves did in the dot-com boom. Jeopardy clues cover an open domain of human knowledge, every subject imaginable, and are full of booby traps for computers, puns, slangs, wordplay, oblique allusions. But in just a few years, Watson has learned, yes, it learned to deal with some of the myriad complexities of English. When it sees the word blondie, for instance, it's very good at figuring out whether Jeopardy means the cookie, the comic strip, or the new wave band. I expected Watson's bag of cognitive tricks to be fairly shallow, but I felt an uneasy sense of familiarity as its programmers briefed us about the big match. The computer's techniques for unraveling Jeopardy clues sounded just like mine. The machine zeroes in on keywords in a clue, then combs its memory, in Watson's case, a 15 terabyte data bank of human knowledge for clusters of associations with those words. It rigorously checks the top hits against all the contextual information it can muster. The category name, the kind of answer being sought, the time, place, and gender hinted in the clue, and so on. And when it feels sure enough, it decides to buzz. This is all an instant intuitive process for the human Jeopardy player, but I felt convinced that under the hood, my brain was doing more or less the same thing. It turns out that the first example that we have of true AI has emulated the most imperfect part of our being, according to us, which is intuition. This is intuition. This is how intuition works. We can't articulate it at times. We don't know how we know the answer in 2 to 3 seconds. But we're damn good at it. That's why we're surviving. That's why we made it. In this book that's, again, on the reading list, it's called The Power of Intuition, there's a really fantastic analogy, at least it moved me, on how data and intuition relate. So it relates to the visual system, how we see. So the eye actually has two parts that are important to this analogy. The fovea, which is right where all the nerves converge at the back of the retina, and then the rest of the eye, which gives you your peripheral vision. The fovea is what lets you see detail. When you're reading, you're focusing on the text, that's your fovea at work. When you're looking at a scene and trying to recreate it on a piece of paper, that's your fovea at work. The peripheral vision, instead, what that does is it orients you in the world, right? It places you in the global space. It helps you navigate. Now, whenever you have an issue with the peripheral vision, like retinosa pigmentosa is one, you're blind. You're medically blind. Like, you can't navigate around the world. You need help to do anything you do. If you have a foveal vision issue, though, I think it's macular degeneration, you can't read anymore, but you can go to the grocery store. You can navigate around the world. Some people can actually drive. I thought this was a really interesting metaphor for how data and intuition kind of relate to each other. We tend to put data first, right? But the reality shows that with the right mindset and the right experience and the right analysis, you need to be guiding yourself with intuition. So you can find the right problem to solve. And then once you've honed in on that, that's when you invoke data. That's when you start doing the analysis that you need to do. It's that time again. And this was just a cute one. He puts up with a lot, right, because we put stuff on him and take pictures of him. Are we ready for the caption? I just wanted to use Bong. Nobody? No? Did someone say Obama? Who said George Clooney? Yes, it was George Clooney. When he was asked, I think, if he'd run for president, and he said, no, of course not. I even drank the Bong water. Thank you. All right, so we're converging on something. And I want you to bear with me again because I want to read you a passage. Stories work for me to remember things, to make a point. So I actually want to read you about a 4 or 5 minute story, okay? So stay with me. The passengers aboard KLM flight 4805 didn't know it, but they were in the hands of one of the most experienced and accomplished pilots in the world. Captain Jacob Van Zanten didn't just have a knack for flying. His attention to detail, methodical approach, and spotless record made him a natural choice to head KLM's safety program. It was no surprise then that the airline was keen to show him off. One magazine ad featured the smiling captain captured it all. KLM, from the people who made punctuality possible. Even seasoned pilots, not exactly the type of individuals prone to swoon, regarded him as something of a celebrity. On the flight deck of the 747 en route to Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to Las Palmas Airport in the Canary Islands, Van Zanten must have felt a sense of pride. Today's trip was moving along with the smooth precision that had become his hallmark. The schedule was straightforward: land in Las Palmas, refuel, and transport a new set of passengers back home to Holland. But then Van Zanten got an urgent message from air traffic control. A terrorist bomb had exploded at the airport flower shop, causing massive chaos on the ground. Las Palmas would be closed until further notice. The captain knew that at times like this, the most important thing to do was remain calm and proceed with caution. He had performed drills preparing for this kind of situation countless times. In fact, Van Zanten had just returned from leading a 6-month safety course on how to react in exactly this kind of situation. Following standard procedure, the captain obeyed orders to land 50 nautical miles from his original destination on the island of Tenerife. There, at 1:10 p.m., his plane joined several others that had been similarly diverted. Now, you don't have to be a seasoned pilot to appreciate that Tenerife was no JFK. It was a tiny airport with a single runway not meant to support jumbo jets. With his plane safely parked at the edge of the runway, the captain checked his watch. Seeing the time, he was struck with a worrisome thought: the mandated rest period. The Dutch government had recently instituted strict, complicated rules to which each pilot had to adhere. After getting in touch with the headquarters and performing some quick calculations, Van Zanten figured that the latest he could take off was 6:30 p.m. Flying after the start of his mandated rest period was out of the question. It wasn't just against policy, it was a crime punishable by imprisonment. But taking the rest period would open its own can of worms. Here in Tenerife, there'd be no replacement crew to take over. Hundreds of passengers would be stranded overnight. That would mean that the airline would have to find them a place to stay, and there weren't enough hotel rooms on the island. In addition, a delay here would initiate a cascade of flight cancellations throughout KLM. A seemingly minor diversion could easily become a logistical nightmare. It's easy to imagine the stress that Van Zanten was experiencing and why he became so determined to save time. It was like being stuck at a red light when you're late for a big meeting. Try as you might to stay calm, you know that your reputation is on the line. Your frustration grows, and there's really not much you can do. But there was one thing Van Zanten could do. The captain decided to keep the passengers on board so that when Las Palmas reopened, he could get back in the air immediately. But air traffic control personnel who worked at Tenerife Tower were of a different mindset. Here was a small airport on a tropical island, now inundated with planes from all over the world that had been diverted because of the Las Palmas explosion. Not only was the tower understaffed, but the air traffic controllers were in no hurry to get the planes out of the gate. They were, in fact, getting ready to listen to a live soccer match on the transistor radios. 20 minutes after landing, Van Zanten received word from the tower that he should let his passengers off. It looked like they would be here for a while. From there, events at Tenerife continued to move forward like molasses. 20 minutes turned into an hour. The captain spent every moment thinking of ways to minimize the delay. He held a strategy session with his crew. He called KLM headquarters to find out exactly how much time he had left before the mandated rest period kicked in. An hour on the ground had turned into two. Then the captain came up on another idea. He decided to refuel at Tenerife and thus shave half an hour off the turnaround in Las Palmas. But this time-saving idea backfired. As soon as Van Zanten started refueling, word came from the Las Palmas airport that it had finally reopened. But it was too late to stop the 35-minute refueling process. Finally, just when it looked like the plane was set to go, nature threw its own wrench into the plan. A thick layer of fog descended upon the runway. Kicking himself over the decision to refuel, Van Zanten became even more intent on getting underway. With the fog growing thicker, visibility dropped to just 300 meters, so poor that gazing out the cockpit window, the captain couldn't see the end of the runway. Van Zanten knew that every moment the fog got worse made it that much likelier that the Tenerife Tower would shut down the airport. He saw that as a window of opportunity to get out of the Tenerife before an overnight stay was closing. It was now or never, time to go. But what the captain did next was completely out of character. Van Zanten revved up the engines and the plane lurched down the runway. "Wait a minute," Van Zanten's co-pilot said in confusion. "We don't have ATC clearance." "I know that," replied the captain as he hit the brakes. "Go ahead and ask them." The co-pilot got on the radio and received airway clearance, which was approval of the flight plan, but the tower said nothing about the vital takeoff clearance. And yet, determined to take off, Van Zanten turned the throttles to full power and roared down the foggy runway. The jumbo jet was gaining momentum when, seemingly out of nowhere, the scariest sight Van Zanten could have imagined appeared before him. A Pan Am 747 was parked across the runway, and Van Zanten was approaching it with takeoff speed. There was no way to stop or swerve. Instinctively, which is funny, not really funny, but you get the point. Instinctively, Van Zanten knew that his only chance was to take off early. "Come on, please," the captain urged his plane. He pulled the aircraft's nose up desperately, dragging its tail on the ground and throwing up a blinding spray of sparks. The nose of Van Zanten's plane managed to narrowly clear the parked 747, but just when it looked like he was in the clear, the underside of Van Zanten's fuselage ripped through the top of the Pan Am plane. The KLM plane burst into a fiery explosion as it hurtled another 500 yards down the runway. Van Zanten, his entire crew, and all of his passengers were killed. In all, 584 people lost their lives that day. The aeronautical community was stunned. It was by far the deadliest airplane collision in history, and it still remains to be the deadliest air collision in history. That was actually an excerpt from the book Sway, and Sway is a beginner's, it's an introduction to behavioral economics, which I think if you're a person that works with other people, which most of us are, you should read that book. The thing is, we are just flawed in three fundamental ways, which I've talked about in the entire presentation, but what does that mean? And how does it relate back to our $64,000 question? The answer is really obvious. We make mistakes constantly. We make mistakes when we least expect we're making mistakes, right? But we very predictably make mistakes, and there's a lot of research out there that concurs with this, that we make mistakes all the time. That has been my experience, and I truly believe that all of you in your gut kind of feel this too. This is why we screw up at constantly building software. All the other stuff is noise. It's all in the WTF bucket. Most of us screw up because from the get-go, we're kind of screwed. Even our perceptions aren't accurate. So I don't want to leave you on this really somber note, because you guys are like, man, you really spoiled the mood. I want to take us back to our echo chamber, come back to software a little bit. And you know, we like to do case studies all the time, and I have hundreds of case studies, and I've seen us present case studies to each other. But what I've seen is every time we present a failure case study, we do all sorts of crazy things to rationalize why the project failed. We tend to commiserate, and we tend to commiserate on what we already know about why things fail, right? So let's go through two case studies, and stay with me for a bit. If you've been listening, then let's see how you perceive these case studies. What do you think went wrong? What do you think went right? So the first one is Channel 9. Most of you probably know what Channel 9 is. You've probably seen the live stage outside. It's one of the biggest brands out of Microsoft. It's got a cult following, and it's been around for 7 or 8 years. My boss actually runs Channel 9 as well as Mix Online. So he came to me a year and a half ago, and he's like, hey, can you help me redesign Channel 9? We'd never had a professional redesign. It was just sort of this site that we had thrown together, and you know, we built a community around it. It was a daunting project because there are a lot of eyeballs on Channel 9. So I said, sure. And we reached out to a lovely agency in Seattle by the name of Blue Flavor, and I brought on some really great people to help me redesign Channel 9, Nick Fink, Kevin Tamora, Matt Brown. But I don't want to talk about the Channel 9 redesign. What I want to talk about is this bright idea that I had as we were redesigning the site. At some point in the euphoria of the moment, I was with the stakeholders, and I was like, we should redesign the logo. And everyone was like, yes. Yeah. So this was the original logo. And the Channel 9 logo is literal. It's a robot. By the way, if you ever wondered where that robot came from, I think Jeff and someone else were sitting around a room, this was before my time, and they were like, we should have a logo. And they were like, what should we do? It's like, let's have a robot. People love robots. Yeah, there's no deep meaning to it. They put a microphone on him. But I think the best logos are created that way. So let's start the logo redesign process. That's from Mortal Kombat. I had to do that. I'm sorry. It just tickled me. It wasn't for you. It was for me. So Kevin was the illustrator, and the first set of logos that came back were these. And when I saw them, time froze. I was like, no! And I tried to take it out off the Basecamp site, but you know how Basecamp is. It's efficient. It does its job. So within a minute, there were stakeholders in my office going, what the? And the reason we felt that way was because we never meant to lose the body, right? So there must have been some communication breakdown. Who knows whose fault it was? Who cares? I was like, look, guys, I'm going to get back to Kevin, and we're going to get the body back, and we're going to just reset, right, start over. I promise that's the last time. I actually had it for all the rounds, and this is a long case study. So these are the logos that Kevin came out with. He did a bunch of discovery with us. And I actually thought they were really nice. I really liked the logo on the left-hand side. And we did kind of say we want to just redesign the logo, right? So Kevin kind of like, you know, quizzed us on how we perceived the logo and stuff. And he came back with this. I was the only one who felt very positive about it. Because I think when I talked to the guys, they were all over the map. I remember someone saying on the right logo, it's like, why does he have that look on his face? What are those clown things, right? This logo went down the drain before most people had seen it. So we went back to the drawing board. And this time, what we did was we decided that we want to go closer to the original Channel 9 guy. And I've condensed all of them into all the rounds into one slide. So we went back to the original 9 guy, which is on the extreme left. And I remember the feedback on this one was, he looks like he's in my closet and looking through the slats and kind of stalking me. And then there was one person who was like, that's not a microphone. I'll let your imagination run wild with that. So that was a no-no. And then people said, why don't we go back to some of the roundedness? We kind of like that. And you can imagine, everyone's frustrated. The stakeholders are frustrated. I'm frustrated. Kevin probably wants to shoot me. So I go back to Kevin, and I'm like, dude, take the original logo, put rounded corners on it. I've never said that, put rounded corners on a logo, but we did. And we came out with the middle section, that was round four or five, I forget. And I loved it, but at that point, I mean, we were pretty tainted in this process, and pretty much everyone hated it. So we decided to pull back. So it's kind of weird, because you start with something, and you pretty much ended up with the same thing over two rounds, and we're spending money at this point. And of course, that's for reference, that's the original logo. Yeah, a brand new logo. Okay, so round six. Now what happened was, I wish I had the foam guy. You guys have seen the little foam guy around, the channel line foam guy. So I sat down with the team and I was like, dudes, we have to like figure out, we have to converge on something, right? Because this project's taking longer than the actual redesign of the site. And it did. So everyone kind of agreed that the one that they felt happiest about was the foam guy. So I was like, how about we take the foam guy and we illustrate the foam guy and call it a day? And they said, okay, cool. So we did that. We illustrated the foam guy. And I think at this point, fatigue had set in, so most of the people were just like, yeah, let's go with this. There was one stakeholder, though, who's like, I just can't see it, right? Why is one of his eyes smaller than the other? And you know, he was making a bunch of noise. So I literally remember taking his head and taking a foam guy, putting it this way, and say, now look at it with one eye closed. And I moved his head around, and I was like, now look at the logo on the screen. Oh. But it makes sense based on what we've learned about perspective. And I started lying in this phase, which is typically, it's about the time that designers start lying. I said we have no budget left, so if you have, you can have two fixes. And you know, everyone gave a fix, which was his hair is kind of messed up. And that was funny. His hair was actually messed up, so we fixed his hair. And this is what we landed on, for reference again. So we laugh about this, right? And we laugh about this because we spent a lot of time. What do you guys think was the top reason this project failed? Absolutely. We didn't need a new logo. I screwed up, plain and simple. We can blame everybody that we want to. But here's the thing. I'd never redesigned a logo in my life. I'm not a brand designer. I've done a lot of things, but I've never done brand design, especially for something that can be so emotional for people. The word logo, actually, by the way, derives from logos, which is a direct reference to Jesus Christ. Logo actually means God. So it's kind of funny that we get so emotional about logo projects not working out, because anyone who's lived in any sort of a culture that does idol worship, you know, you don't mess with the idols. You just don't. They're not G.I. Joes. So I think everything else is WTF. This project should have never come into existence. Of course, there were like strong negative anchoring effects going on. People had this nostalgia about the old logo, and then they saw all these really horrible, to them, faces, right? And human beings, and this is why I said you should probably read it, if you haven't read about behavioral economics, can't actually tell the intrinsic value of anything. They only relate it to other things, right? So when you have two very opposing anchors that are always playing with your emotions, it's very tough to place yourself somewhere. And the place where you're going to place yourself is most likely take a conservative approach, which is, I'm pissed. And we had subjective perceptions and those kind of things. All right, it's probably time for one more. What, it's blurred. When I actually show this to my wife, she's like, that's not blurred. I'm not kidding, I didn't doctor this. He was sitting like this when we walked into the living room, and he sat like this for a 30-minute photo shoot. We literally took 3,000 pictures of him. He's a weird one. Okay, are we ready for the tagline? Nobody. She sings in Vegas. Yeah, I heard it here first somewhere. I'll remember your face. Don't worry about this. It is Celine Dion. She actually said that. That's even more offensive than our music to me. Why would you say that? Because I think in images, and I was thinking of Celine Dion. Let's do one more case study. We kind of saw a case study that went awry. Let's do one that actually did well. Did you guys see the Lost Worlds Fair project when IE9 came out? Okay, so IE9 was going to beta a few months ago, and the whole theme around IE, the philosophy around IE has been the browser is at the stage and the content is the star. So what we decided to do with IE9 was we reached out to like 20 to 30 really awesome designers and developers and said, can you build something that helps us celebrate the launch of IE9? Josh and I were pulled into the process at some point, and we looked through the projects that had been commissioned. We had folks like Joshua Davis and stuff we'd commissioned. And we didn't see one that struck us as obvious, which is typography. We thought that just our experiences had told us that typography was something that people were really anticipating with IE9, WAF. So for those of you who haven't seen the project, let me actually give you a quick demo of it. It's going to be tough to control. Okay, so Lost Worlds Fair, the whole idea behind the project was to show off WAF. And WAF, for those of you who don't know it, is basically the future of typography on the web. It allows us to put any font that we want on a web page, right? Something that we could only do for our local machines will soon become a reality for any web page. So what we decided to do were take three layouts, basically. And the idea was to show how the web has become print quality. So one of the ones that was really popular, so I actually contacted Jason Santa Maria for this project, if you guys know him, and we started exchanging emails, and then we got Frank on board, and we got Nas on board, and Trent and Dave, and each one of them did a layout. So let me take you to what probably is the most popular one. So this was Atlantis, and I'll sort of just scroll through it. It's really whimsical. It's just a journey to Atlantis, right? You just keep going down, and there are these fun things to read and see. And it goes on and on. It's just a project that I think when most people see it, they're just like, wow, that's beautiful. Frank is just, he's my favorite designer on the web right now. We'll get there. And you can see it's playing off 20,000 leagues under the sea, and you finally get there. Now, it's probably not clear to you why this is cool. You're like, okay, it's a cool design. Why it's cool is, let me try and demonstrate. All right, let's go to this, for instance. How am I going to do this? Can't see the edge. All right, let's move this to this side. I wanted Firebug. And then move this back. Am I over the inspect element?
Yes.
I am. Okay. Did not plan this part of the presentation clearly. And you go to Atlantis and you change it to Las Vegas. There is no image on this page for the text. It's all text. Every font that you see up there is just text. It's going to be an awesome world, right? So you look at the whole thing. It's all text. You can go modify any of this text. And that's what we wanted to show, that the web is ready for real typography. Right. We could only think about doing this in print. And there were two other layouts, which I'll let you go explore yourself. It's Lost Worlds for lostworldsfairs.com. So I had reached out to Jason, and I kind of pitched this project to him, and he got interested. And this is just an excerpt from one of the emails that we had. And he was like, hey, can you scope it down? I mean, we were starting with nothing, right? We were at the drawing board. And he was like, can you scope it down for me? So kind of Josh and I brainstormed, and we're like, and we came up with a general framework of the idea, is we wanted some sort of broadsheets on the internet. We didn't know what the topic was, so we called it a type of poetry, because both Josh and I read poetry, which probably, again, I shouldn't have admitted on video. And we send them this little excerpt, and then I kind of told Jason, look, you run with it, but this is the framework. What I want us to do is demonstrate the power of WAF in the context of HTML5. And Jason really ran with it. He changed it to Lost Worlds, and I truly believe that the project would have been 1/10 successful if we went with poetry. I just don't think it would have worked out. And a lot of good came out of this project. Lettering.js, which is a jQuery plugin for typography, is really taken off now. But the most interesting thing was, at this point, and I took the screenshot maybe a couple days ago, there are about 4,200 tweets on this project. It's been seen a little over 6 million times on Twitter. It's the second most popular project that we commissioned for IE, and it's actually way more popular than a lot of other projects, right? And it was a hindsight. This was a classic example where the project came into existence because of a gut feeling. If Joshua and I tried to sit down and articulate what the web design community is excited about in HTML5, and we tried to create a spreadsheet around it, most likely Canvas, video, audio, all those things would bubble to the top, because the only data out there, the only noise we've made is about those kind of things. But between the two of us, we have 30 years of experience on the web. We felt this. We've been a part of this movement. We felt all this pain. So for us, it was an obvious one. We're like, wouldn't it be cool to do this? It was a tough sell. And right to the end, we didn't get people to buy into it. So one of the things that really helped in this project was we were also able to step back and know our own limitations and let Jason take over. I actually saw one comp between that email and when Jason launched the project. I basically told him, dude, run with it, right? I trust you to do the right thing. I think Jason is far more creative than I am. And one of the things we did was we lied through our teeth. Again, I shouldn't be telling this on video. But every time someone came into my office and knocked on the door, it's like, where's that project? I'd be like, oh man, they're really busy. It's coming tomorrow. The first time anyone saw the project was 12 hours before we launched it. We just believed that was the way to do it. So, let's move forward a little bit. Have you guys seen this poster? Is it zooming in? I can't tell how it is. It's supposed to be dramatic. So it's tempting to say, okay, so what's the takeaway here? Like, it seems like if we're born as people, we just need to kill ourselves. And please don't take that away. For me, this has been a 3-year journey. So I joined Microsoft 3 years ago, and one of the first things I did with one of my friends, Eric Saltwell, and Tom, and I kind of just met Thomas Lewis at that time, is I pitched this project that we should create a poster to celebrate the web designer. And it was based off some of the research that Eric had done around web design. And we got some funding for the project, and we went and contacted X-Plane, and then I worked with X-Plane for 2.5 to 3 months and micromanaged every detail of this poster. This is a bitter poster. I mean, it's a very popular one. We've given away 10,000 copies of this poster over 3 years, and it's kind of has a little cult following. I get emails every day asking if I have any more left, but we don't. But if you look through each of the details, you'll see my bitterness, because I had come from a work environment that was very tough, and I couldn't understand at that point why it was so tough to work with people. This kind of captured my perception of what it took to build a website. And the reality is, even today, this is kind of what it takes. It's chaotic. The one thing that strikes you about this visualization is it's utter chaos, and it's chaos caused by people. Fast forward 3 years. Since then, for me, it's now turned into a hobby, and now I talk about it. But it was about trying to deal with my own emotions around why things always failed in software. And where I am today is I can't see the half of the glass that's empty. I just see the half of the glass that's full. And I never expected that, because I was just trying to answer my own questions about why things keep failing. In all the stuff that I read, something weird happened. Actually, two weird things happened. I have closure, so I'm just very positive about things. Like, I politics and those kind of things don't faze me. But I didn't expect, the thing I didn't expect is that just exposing myself to all these topics would make me a lot more efficient and much better at my job. I'm able to avert crises, like some people call me, you know, a prediction machine. Like I'm able to see things that I think other people can't see just because I understand us a little more. I understand myself a little more. So it's been kind of therapeutic. So if you want to take away something from this presentation, then take away that it helped me. And for me, this is a nice bookend to 3 years where I started off feeling, God damn, people suck. And today I can just say, the root cause of most software failures are people, and that's cool. So last one for the road. He's just sitting. I heard it somewhere back there. Okay, it's you. Don't leave yet. So the prize is actually the poster. Hopefully you like it. It's fairly popular. You could probably sell it on eBay for like $1. I think there should be someone there. So come collect your prizes. I have handouts about all this research and the stuff that I've been reading. Thank you for being extremely attentive and staying through an hour. I'll be here if you want to chit-chat. I usually don't do a Q&A because I've found that people are just more comfortable just coming up and chatting. But if you feel the need to, does anyone want to ask a question? Yeah, after that, why would you? I just rejected all of you. Thank you.